Section 10 of The Diary of a Provincial Lady by E. M. Delafield. This Legamus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. July 18th at Santagat. Vicissitudes of travel very strange, and am struck, as often, by enormous dissimilarity between journeys undertaken in real life and as reported in fiction. Can remember very few novels in which train journey of any kind does not involve either a hectic encounter with member of opposite sex leading to tense emotional issue, b discovery of murdered body in hideously battered condition under circumstances which utterly defy detection, c elopement between two people, each of whom is married to somebody else, culminating in severe disillusionment or lofty renunciation. Nothing of all this enlivens my own peregrinations, but, on the other hand, the night not without incident. Second-class carriage full, and am not fortunate enough to obtain corner seat. American young gentleman sits opposite, and elderly French couple, with talkative friend wearing blue beret, who trims his nails with a pocket-knife and tells us about the state of the wine trade. I have dusty and elderly mother in black on one side, and her two sons, names turn out to be Gagust and Dédé, on the other. Dédé looks about 15 but wears socks, which I think a mistake, but must beware of insularity. Towards 11 o'clock we all subside into silence, except the blue beret, who is now launched on tennis champions, and has much to say about all of them. American young gentleman looks uneasy at mention of any of his compatriots, but evidently does not understand enough French to follow blue beret's remarks, which is as well. Just as we all, except indefatigable beret, now eating small sausage rolls, drop one by one into slumber, train stops at station, and fragments of altercation break out in corridor concerning admission, or otherwise, of someone evidently accompanied by large dog. This is opposed by masculine voice repeating steadily, at short intervals, "Un chien n'est pas une personne," and heavily backed by assenting chorus repeating after him, "Mais non, un chien n'est pas une personne." To this I fall asleep, but wake a long time afterwards to sounds of appealing inquiry floating in from corridor. Mais voyons, n'est-ce pas qu'un chien n'est pas une personne? The point still unsettled when I sleep again, and in the morning no more is heard, and I speculate in vain as to whether owner of the chien remained with him on the station, or is having tête-à-tête journey with him in separate carriage altogether. Wash inadequately in extremely dirty accommodation provided, after waiting some time in lengthy queue. Make distressing discovery that there is no way of obtaining breakfast until train halts at Avignon. Break this information later to American young gentleman, who falls into deep distress and says that he does not know the French for grapefruit. Neither do I, but am able to inform him decisively that he will not require it. Train is late, and does not reach Avignon till nearly 10. American young gentleman has a severe panic, and assures me that if he leaves the train it will start without him. This happened once before at Davenport, Iowa. In order to avoid similar calamity on this occasion, I offer to procure him a cup of coffee and two rolls, and successfully do so, but attend first to my own requirements. We all brighten after this, and Gagust announces his intention of shaving. His mother screams and says, "Mais c'est fou," with which I privately agree, and everybody else remonstrates with Gagust, except Dédé, who is wrapped in gloom, and points out that the train is rocking and he will cut himself. The blue beret goes so far as to predict that he will decapitate himself, at which everybody screams. Gagust remains adamant, and produces shaving apparatus and a little mug, which is given to Dédé to hold. We sit around in great suspense, and Gagust is supported by one elbow by his mother, while he conducts operations, to a conclusion which produces no perceptible change whatever in his appearance. After this excitement, we all suffer from reaction and sink into hot and dusty silence. Scenery gets rocky and sandy, with heat haze shimmering over all, and occasional glimpses of bright blue and green sea. At intervals, train stops and ejects various people. We lose the elderly French couple, who leave a thermos behind them and have to be screamed at by Gagust from the window, and then the blue beret, eloquent to the last, and turning round on the platform to bow as train moves off again. Gagust, Dédé, and the mother remain with me to the end, as they are going on as far as Antibes. American young gentleman gets out when I do, but lose sight of him altogether in excitement of meeting Rose, charming in yellow embroidered linen. She says that she is glad to see me, and adds that I look a rag, which is true, as I discover on reaching hotel and looking-glass, but kindly omits to add that I have smuts on my face, and that petticoat has mysteriously descended 2.5 inches below my dress, imparting final touch of degradation to general appearance. She recommends bath and bed, and I agree to both, but refuse proffered cup of tea, feeling this would be altogether too reminiscent of English countryside and quite out of place. I ask, insanely, if letters from home are awaiting me, which, unless they were written before I left, they could not possibly be. Rose inquires after Robert and the children, and when I reply that I feel I ought not really to have come away without them, she again recommends bed. Feel that she is right, and go there. July 23rd. Cannot avoid contrasting deliriously rapid flight of time when on a holiday, with very much slower passage of days, and even hours, in other and more familiar surroundings. Memo. This disposes once and for all of fallacy that days seem long when spent in complete idleness. They seem, on the contrary, very much longer when filled with ceaseless activities. Rose, always so gifted in discovering attractive and interesting friends, is established in circle of gifted, and in some cases actually celebrated, personalities. We all meet daily on rocks and bathe in sea. Temperature and surroundings very, very different to those of English Channel or Atlantic Ocean, and consequently find myself emboldened to the extent of quite active swimming. Cannot, however, compete with a Viscountess, who dives, or her friend, who has unique and very striking method of doing backfall into the water. Am indeed led away by spirit of emulation into attempting dive on one solitary occasion, and am convinced that I have plumbed the depths of the Mediterranean, have doubts, in fact, of ever leaving it again. But on inquiring of extremely kind spectator, famous headmistress, how I went in, she replies gently, about level with the water, she thinks, and we say no more about it. July 25th. Vicky writes affectionately but briefly, Mademoiselle at greater length and quite illegibly, but evidently full of hopes that I am enjoying myself. Am touched, and send each a picture postcard. Robin's letter, written from school, arrives later, and contains customary allusions to boys unknown to me. Also, information that he has asked two of them to come and stay with him in the holidays, and has accepted invitation to spend a week with another. Postscript adds straightforward inquiry. Have I bought any chocolate yet? I do so forthwith. July 26th. Observe in the glass that I look 10 years younger than on arrival here, and am gratified. This, moreover, in spite of what I cannot help viewing as perilous adventure, recently experienced in, temporarily, choppy sea, agitated by vent d'est, in which no one but Rose's Viscountess attempts to swim. She indicates immense and distant rock, and announces her intention of swimming to it. I say that I will go too. Long before we are halfway there, I know that I shall never reach it, and hope that Robert's second wife will be kind to the children. Viscountess, swimming calmly, says, "Am I all right?" I reply, "Oh, quite," and am immediately submerged. Query. Is this a judgment? Continue to swim. Rock moves further and further away. I reflect that there will be something distinguished about the headlines announcing my demise in such exalted company, and mentally frame one or two that I think would look well in local paper. I'm just turning my attention to paragraph in our parish magazine when I hit a small rock and am immediately submerged again. Mysteriously rise again from the foam, though not in the least, as I know too well, like Venus. Death by drowning said to be preceded by mental panorama of entire past life. Distressing reflection which very nearly causes me to sink again. Even one recollection from my past, if injudiciously selected, disconcerts me in the extreme, and cannot at all contemplate entire series. Suddenly perceive that space between myself and rock has actually diminished. Viscountess, who has kept near me and worn slightly anxious expression throughout, achieves it safely, and presently find myself grasping at sharp projections with tips of my fingers and bleeding profusely at the knees. Perceive that I have been, as they say, spared. Memo. Must try and discover for what purpose, if any. Am determined to take this colossal achievement as a matter of course, and merely make literary reference to Byron swimming the Hellespont, which would sound better if said in less of a hurry, and when not obliged to gasp and spit out several gallons of water. Minor but nerve-wracking little problem here suggests itself. What substitute for a pocket handkerchief exists when sea-bathing? Can conceive of no occasion, except possibly funeral of nearest and dearest, when this homely little article more frequently and urgently required. Answer, when it comes, anything but satisfactory. I say that I am cold, which is true, and shall go back across the rocks. Viscountess, with remarkable tact, does not attempt to dissuade me, and I go. July 27th. End of holiday quite definitely in sight, and everyone very kindly says, why not stay on? I refer, in turn, to Robert and the children, and add, though not aloud, the servants, the laundry, the Women's Institute, repainting the outside of Bath, and the state of my overdraft. Everyone expresses civil regret at my departure, and I go so far as to declare recklessly that I shall be coming back next year, which I well know to be unlikely in the extreme. Spend last evening sending picture postcards to everyone to whom I have been intending to send them ever since I started. July 29th, London. Return journey accomplished under greatly improved conditions, travelling first class in company with one of Rose's most distinguished friends. Should much like to run across Lady B by chance in Paris or elsewhere, but no such gratifying coincidence supervenes. Shall take care, however, to let her know circles in which I have been moving. Crossing as tempestuous as ever, and again have recourse to an Austrian army, with same lack of success as before. Boat late. Train even more so. Last available train for west of England has left Paddington long before I reach Victoria, and am obliged to stay night in London. Put through long-distance call to tell Robert this, but line is, as usual, in a bad way, and all I can hear is, what? As Robert, on his side, can apparently hear even less, we do not get far. I find that I have no money, in spite of having borrowed from Rose. Expenditure, as invariably happens, has exceeded estimate, but confide all to secretary of my club, who agrees to trust me, but adds, rather disconcertingly, as it's for one night only. July 30th. Readjustment sometimes rather difficult, after absence of unusual length and character. July 31st. The beginning of the holidays signalled, as usual, by the making of appointments with dentist and doctor. Photographs taken at St. Agathe arrive, and I am, perhaps naturally, much more interested in them than anybody else appears to be. Bathing dress shows up as being even more becoming than I thought it was, though hair, on the other hand, not at its best, probably owing to salt water. Notice, regretfully, how much more time I spend in studying views of myself than on admirable group of delightful friends, or even beauties of nature, as exemplified in camera studies of sea and sky. Presents for Vicky, Mademoiselle, and our vicar's wife all meet with acclamation, and am gratified. Blue-flowered chintz frock, however, bought at Saint Agathe for 63 francs, no longer becoming to me, as sunburn fades and original sallowness returns to view. Even Mademoiselle, usually so sympathetic in regard to clothes, eyes chintz frock doubtfully, and says, "Tiens, on dirait un bal masque." As she knows, and I know, that the neighbourhood never has, and never will, run to bal masque, this equals unqualified condemnation of blue chintz, and I remove it in silence to furthest corner of the wardrobe. "Helen Wills," says cook, about to produce more kittens. Cannot say if Robert does or does not know this. Spend much time in writing to, and hearing from, unknown mothers whose sons have been invited here by Robin, and one grandmother, with whose descendant Robin is to spend a week. Curious impossibility of combining dates and trains convenient to us all renders this whole question harassing in the extreme. Grandmother, especially, sends unlimited letters and telegrams, to all of which I feel bound to reply, mostly with civil assurances of gratitude for her kindness in having Robin to stay. Very, very difficult to think of new ways of wording this. Moreover, must reserve something for letter I shall have to write when visit is safely over. August 1st. Return of Robin, who has grown and looks pale. He has also purchased large bottle of brilliantine and applied it to his hair, which smells like inferior chemist's shop. Do not like to be unsympathetic about this, so merely remain silent, while Vicky exclaims rapturously that it is lovely, which is also Robin's own opinion. They get excited and scream, and I suggest the garden. Robin says that he is hungry, having had no lunch. Practically, he adds conscientiously. Practically turns out to be packet of sandwiches, two bottles of atrocious liquid called cherry ciderette, slab of milk chocolate, two bananas purchased on journey, and small sample tin of cheese biscuits, swapped by boy called Sherlock for Robin's last year's copy of Pop's Annual. Customary rather touching display of affection between Robin and Vicky much to the fore, and I'm sorry to feel that repeated experience of holidays has taught me not to count for one moment upon its lasting more than 24 hours, if that. Query: does motherhood lead to cynicism? This contrary to every convention of art, literature, or morality, but cannot altogether escape conviction that answer may be in the affirmative. In spite of this, however, cannot remain quite unmoved on hearing Vicky inform cook that, when she marries, her husband will be exactly like Robin. Cook replies indulgently, "That's right, but come out of that sauce-boat, there's a good girl. And what about Master Robin's wife?" To which Robin rejoins, he doesn't suppose he'll be able to get a wife exactly like Vicky, as she's so good there couldn't be another one. August 2nd. Noteworthy what astonishing difference made an entire household by presence of one additional child. Robert finds one marble, which he unfortunately steps upon, mysterious little empty box with hole in bottom, and half of torn sponge on the stairs, and says, "This house is a perfect shambles," which I think excessive. Mademoiselle refers to sounds emitted by Robin, Vicky, the dog, and Helen Wills, all apparently gone mad together in the hayloft, as tohu bohu. Very expressive word. Meal times, especially lunch, very, very far from peaceful. From time to time remember, with pained astonishment, theories subscribed to in pre-motherhood days as to inadvisability of continually saying don't incessant fault-finding, and so on. Should now be sorry indeed to count number of times that I find myself forced to administer these and similar checks to the dear children. Am often reminded of enthusiastic accounts given me by Angela of other families, and admirable discipline obtaining there without effort on either side. Should like, or far more probably, should not like, to hear what dear Angela says about our house when visiting mutual friends or relations. Rose writes cheerfully, still in south of France, sky still blue, rocks red, and bathing as perfect as ever. Experience curious illusion of receiving communication from another world, visited many eons ago and dimly remembered. Weather abominable, and customary difficulty experienced of finding indoor occupation for children that shall be varied, engrossing, and reasonably quiet. Cannot imagine what will happen if these conditions still prevail when visiting schoolfellow, Henry by name, arrives. I ask Robin what his friend's tastes are, and he says, "Oh, anything." I inquire if he likes cricket, and Robin replies, "Yes, he expects so." Does he care for reading? Robin says that he does not know. I give it up, and write to Army and Navy stores for large tin of picnic biscuits. Messrs. R. Sydenham and two unknown firms from places in Holland send me little books relating to indoor bulbs. R. Sydenham particularly optimistic, and though admitting that failures have been known, pointing out that all, without exception, have been owing to neglect of directions on page 22. Immerse myself in page 22, and see that there is nothing for it but to get R. Sydenham's special mixture for growing R. Sydenham's special bulbs. Mention this to Robert, who does not encourage scheme in any way, and refers to last November. Cannot at the moment think of really good answer, but shall probably do so in church on Sunday, or in other surroundings equally inappropriate for delivering it. August 3rd. Difference of opinion arises between Robin and his father as to the nature and venue of former's evening meal, Robin making sweeping assertions to the effect that all boys of his age have proper late dinner downstairs, and Robert replying curtly, "More fools their parents," which I privately think unsuitable language for use before children. Final and unsatisfactory compromise results in Robin's coming nightly to the dining-room and partaking of soup, followed by interval and ending with dessert, during the whole of which Robert maintains disapproving silence, and I talk to both at once on entirely different subjects. Life of a wife and mother sometimes very wearing. Moreover, Vicky offended at not being included in what she evidently looks upon as nightly banquet of Lucullan magnificence, and covertly supported in this rebellious attitude by Mademoiselle. Am quite struck by extraordinary persistence with which Vicky, day after day, inquires why she can't stay up to dinner too, and equally phenomenal number of times that I reply with unvarying formula that 6 years old is too young, darling. Weather cold and disagreeable, and I complain. Robert asserts that it is really quite warm, only I don't take enough exercise. Have often noticed curious and prevalent masculine delusion to the effect that sympathy should never, on any account, be offered when minor ills of life are in question. Days punctuated by recurrent question as to whether grass is or is not too wet to be sat upon by children, and whether they shall or shall not wear their woollen pullovers. To all inquiries as to whether they are cold, they invariably reply, with aggrieved expressions, that they are boiling. Should like scientific or psychological explanation of this singular state of affairs, and mentally reserve the question for bringing forward on next occasion of finding myself in intellectual society. This, however, seems at the moment remote in the extreme. Cook says that unless help is provided in the kitchen, they cannot possibly manage all the work. I think this unreasonable and quite unnecessary expense. Am also aware that there is no help to be obtained at this time of the year. Am disgusted at hearing myself reply in hypocritically pleasant tone of voice that, very well, I will see what can be done. Servants, in truth, make cowards of us all. August 7th. Local flower show takes place. We walk about in Burberry's on wet grass and say that it might have been much worse, and look at the day they had last week at West Warmington. Am forcibly reminded of what I have heard of Ruth Draper's admirable sketch of County Bazaar, but try hard not to think about this. Our vicar's wife takes me to look at the schoolchildren's needlework, laid out in tent amidst onions, begonias, and other vegetable products. Just as I am admiring pink cotton camisole, embroidered with mauve pansies, strange boy approaches me and says, "If I please, the little girl isn't very well, and can't be got out of the swing-boat, and will I come, please?" I go, our vicar's wife following, and saying, absurdly, that it must be the heat, and those swing-boats have always seemed to her very dangerous, ever since there was a fearful accident at her old home, when the whole thing broke down, and 7 people were killed, and a good many of the spectators injured. A relief, after this, to find Vicky merely green in the face, still clinging obstinately to the ropes, and disregarding 2 men below, saying, "Come along out of it, missy," and, "Now then, my dear," and Mademoiselle in terrific state of agitation, clasping her hands and pacing backwards and forwards, uttering many Gallic ejaculations and adjurations to the saints. Robin has removed himself to furthest corner of the ground, and is feigning interest in immense cart-horse tied up in red ribbons. Note, dear Robin, perhaps not so utterly unlike his father as one is sometimes tempted to suppose. I tell Vicky very, very shortly that unless she descends instantly, she will go to bed early every night for a week. Unfortunately, tremendous outburst of Land of Hope and Glory from brass band compels me to say this in undignified bellow, and to repeat it 3 times before it has any effect, by which time quite large crowd has gathered round. General outburst of applause when at last swingboat is brought to a standstill, and Vicky, mottled to the last degree, is lifted out by man in check coat and tweed cap, who says, "Here we are, Amy Johnson," to fresh applause. Vicky removed by Mademoiselle not a moment too soon. Our vicar's wife says that all children are alike, and it may be a touch of ptomaine poisoning, one never knows, and why not come and help her judge decorated perambulators? Meet several acquaintances and newly arrived Miss Pankerton, who has bought small house in village, and on whom I have not yet called. She wears pince-nez, and is said to have been at Oxford. All I can get out of her is that the whole thing reminds her of Dostoevsky. Feel that I neither know nor care what she means. Am convinced, however, that I have not heard the last of either Miss P. or Dostoevsky, as she assures me that she is the most unconventional person in the whole world, and never stands on ceremony. If she meets an affinity, she adds, she follows it directly, and then nothing can stop her. She just follows the impulse of the moment, and may as like as not stroll in for breakfast, or be strolled in upon for after-dinner coffee. Am quite unable to contemplate Robert's reaction to Miss P. and Dostoevsky at breakfast, and bring the conversation to an end as quickly as possible. Find Robert, our vicar, and neighbouring squire looking at horses. Our vicar and neighbouring squire talk about the weather, but do not say anything new. Robert says nothing. Get home towards 8 o'clock, strangely exhausted, and am discouraged at meeting both maids just on their way to the flower show dance. Cook says encouragingly that the potatoes are in the oven, and everything else on the table, and she only hopes Pussy hasn't found her way in, on account of the butter. Eventually do the washing up, while Mademoiselle puts children to bed, and I afterwards go up and read Tanglewood Tales aloud. Query, mainly rhetorical, why are non-professional women, if married and with children, so frequently referred to as leisured? Answer comes there none. End of section 10.